showing up a little bit early today. We have a pretty busy agenda. And we have a forum, so we'll go ahead and get started. First up on our list today is a discussion about the RPU infrastructure policies. Mark or Dave, you want
to
start off?
Yeah.
I brought the board member because I can't tell you more because I don't know much.
That's always good.
You're a short time.
That's right. That's right. And I'm a short timer, too. Really just wanted to, as a courtesy to the council, the city government, want to let you know that we are considering, the board is heading in the direction of establishing a connection fee, which we've really never had before. Most utilities would call it a line extension policy because the costs are associated with literally extending the lines out to new developments or whatever. It's something we came across about a year and a half ago. We were going through our rate studies. The key rate making principle that we've always abided by is to pass costs to those who cause them. So if you're a expensive customer, then we should make you have an expensive bill. Right? It just flows to those who create the demand for the service. Right? So in the past, clearly, there's really never been, as far as I can tell, a fee for a new connection, which is a little startling. But if you're trying to grow your city from zero to something, then that's great. But now that we're at something, we're a little beyond that, I think. Nothing political assigned to it. It's just when you look through the books, you just go, well, why is this a freebie? Right? So that's really the whole nature of the discussion. We'll likely have four rate classes, and I'm using likely because it's not finished. We've had a consultant come back and give us one set of proposals. We want to wait. There's value to having a new customer in the system. Right? That's good, but it helps spread some of our other costs around. So there's been a lot of give and take internally and with the consultant. Just how do you value that? How many years of service do you see from, say, a residential customer? And how does that equate to the connection fee? At one point, the consultant thought a typical connection fee for a residential might be $90, $90. But from there, it gets very difficult. The commercial, whether it's small or large, are very difficult. They're all one-offs. And so those will likely do on either a true cost basis or an estimated cost basis. They're pretty good at doing this by now. How many feet of wire, how many poles, that kind of thing. And just run that out as a bill and then credit back whatever the future value is determined to be. So that's just kind of the landscape, if you will. That's, and again, just trying to give you all a heads up so that somebody doesn't just corner me in the hallway.
When do you think that will be figured out?
Probably first quarter of the year. We had hoped to have it in the rate package that just came to you, but we're behind. There were more nuances to this than we expected. So those of us who were optimistic thought it'd be here by now.
Okay. So help me understand, kind of at a high level, the finances. Are we running a deficit, or is this fee meant to cover a deficit, or is this new revenue stream?
Well, I guess it's a new revenue stream, but today those costs are covered. Right? They're just covered by existing customers. So those costs would come into a bucket, if you will, and just be divided up as a system cost to all the customers. It's just part of the infrastructure, if you will. It usually would be related to demand cost, and it's going to get too deep too quick. It's just to the cost of the wires. And so that system cost today is just borne by everyone.
Maybe, going back from sitting through the meetings on these, we have a person who comes in and does our rate studies for us, and he's done it. That's where we came up with the different rate structures that we have, trying to make sure that each different user group is paying the fair amount to cover their costs. And one of the things that we discovered is, in certain circumstances, not all circumstances, we're putting a pretty hefty subsidy into new development. Now, in cases like some of the apartment buildings that probably not going to be any, there won't be any charge because there's actually no subsidy there when you figure out how the whole system works together. And in this particular case, though, there are some cases where clearly the existing users are paying to subsidize new hookups, which would violate our internal policy of placing the cost back on the those who are causing the costs. And rather than trying to calculate this on our own, because you could see real quickly how the two opposing sides would have very different views on what that fee should be set at, we relied on the same person, Mark Beauchamp, that came in and has done these rate studies for us, and he's coming up with the proposed mechanism to ensure that the right folks are covering the right costs.
I'm still trying to understand, though, what the money would necessarily go for, why we need the additional revenue generated by fees.
It's not revenue. It would decrease other... It's not a huge amount of money. We're talking about $130, $140 million budget in total. These fees would be on the order of $2 million, $1 to $2 million, thank you. So, in essence, that cost comes off of the cost for the rates the next time we have to cost out all the other things that we do. Right? There's $2 million that is now paid for directly by the new user.
It's just changing where the money's coming from. It comes off of the rates, it goes on to the fees over time.
I have a question. On the line extensions, you indicated, Dave, that they're covered by the existing customers.
Sure.
Will the existing customers receive
a decrease?
Well, yes.
If it had been part of the package that just came to you, you could have said that the rates didn't go up as much as they would have if we hadn't backed that out. I'm not sure if that's making any sense. We really start the whole process from, well, what is it going to cost me next year to run the whole business, right? And then those pieces have to be assigned to users. Well, the next time that we do that, this $1 to $2 million of new service will actually have a source of revenue goes along with it, so that's covered by itself. Okay, I got that. It's just off to the side. And it won't be in that pool of the other $140 million or so that needs to be covered by other rates.
Mr. Campion, then Mr. Mayor.
What's the revenue of the system? You said the
$140 million. Okay.
Yeah. That's total budget for RP.
Sorry.
Electric.
Okay. Mr. Mayor?
Do you see this going to an individual homeowner or to the developer that's developing new?
It'd likely be a developer.
Yeah, that would be part of the...
Someone that moves into an existing home, there's
nothing there.
Just, yeah. Line needs to be extended. Looking at the discussion with Mark Beauchamp, the consultant, we looked at, okay, so if I started development 10 miles from town, you're in town but 10 miles off the system, that's about as bad as you can get, right? I have to run new wire out to you. If you're right next door to a nice big transformer and, then the fee is less. That's what will happen in the commercial world. For residentials, you don't run huge wires for them. Mm-hmm. Developments are fairly easy to feed, and they typically are relatively near in. So.
Thank you. Although, in reality, when you talk about assessing that against a developer, ultimately it ends up with a homeowner.
Oh, certainly.
Right.
You bet.
Right. So their price is going to go up.
As it should.
The other hand on there, Randy, is that today it just falls on an existing rate payer.
Yeah.
So somebody moves into the new house, has a new power line, courtesy of all the other people who are already paying the rates. So.
Okay. All right. Other questions, comments, or Mark, or other RPU staff, you had more to share, or?
We don't really have any more details than that, I'm afraid. So.
We received the report. I saw that.
Yeah, I guess I would just add that we have reached out to the development community also to give them a heads up that this is being considered. I met with John Eichen and Keith Cousins of the Rochester Area Builders last week. We are setting up a time to meet with them at one of their breakfast meetings in December to kind of explain this policy, where we're going with it, the rationale behind it. So we want to reach out to those that will be impacted by this potential policy change ahead of time to let them know that discussions that are taking place.
Well, and just to use the word policy change, but I would say that this is actually reflective of what our current policies are in correcting the implementation, because RPU has a long established history that our policy is we do not let one group of users subsidize other groups of users. This is bringing us in conformance with this long-standing policy, And ultimately, I believe this is being done. It's an RPU board. It's an RPU decision to be made, but it's something that's different, so everyone should be aware. But to not pursue this for whatever reasons one might choose to not pursue this would fundamentally undercut this long-standing RPU policy that's been in place for longer than we've all been here.
When will this come to the council?
When's Mark due back with his finals?
I'm guessing probably either end of first quarter, early second quarter of 2017. In conversations with Terry, the board has the authority to enact the line extension policy that will outline how it's implemented. The fees that go along with that ultimately will come to the council for council approval, similar to the rates. So I would expect to be back at the council with kind of the fee schedule, maybe second quarter of 2017.
Okay, Mr. Campion.
I guess I would just ask, and I know you guys seem to have the appropriate amount of sensitivity to this particular issue, that we keep this grounded in reality about what dollar amounts we're talking mm-hmm. about, because I think I did receive a call from RAB to talk about they wanted to have an opportunity to weigh in on it. And I think one of the ways we drive this to practical policy is just to focus on actual dollar amounts instead of fictional dollar amounts right. about what we could be talking about. And I think you did a great job of, you know, if it's $90 a house, if that's the number we're talking about in a $200,000 house, looking at it as kind of a more practical way than
right.
kind of fear something that doesn't exist. So I appreciate that. I guess I'd just ask for continue to kind of focus on
sure.
that as a sensitive issue for homeowners.
Okay. Anything else?
I've got some loose items. The potential internet utility discussion. We still owe you, we, the staff, owes you quotes on market study and a study of other cities' experiences. Mm-hmm. So that's yet to come back. A little up in the air is project management of those studies, who's going to bear the survey costs. I guess that can all be part of the discussion at that time, but you ought to keep that in mind. We've been going through financing associated with some new generation equipment. So the bond market is very much on the board's mind, and we were reminded by the financial staff that if we were to fold in a cable utility right into what we have already, the bond market would not look favorably on that. This is an item that really needs to stand on its own, and I'd urge you to think sooner rather than later about actually creating a utility that, you know, has its own cost center, profit center, its income center. So that all that work could kind of be carried by that utility somehow, even if it ends up on existing staff. Like I said, the financing will be a challenge. If we were to try to commingle that with the electric utility, it'll sink those bonds, but they won't go, not at a good rate. So, you know, we cause harm to the existing utility. And the last one was, since I'm on my way out and at the end of the year, it's overall status. RPU is in good shape. That's nice to be able to say. Financially sound, headed in the right direction. I'm not sure you'll recall, but a couple of years ago we started moving toward what's called a utility basis of accounting, which is a little more of, today I describe the process as looking at, okay, what cost do I have next year, and now what income do I have to gather? The utility basis throws into that the cost of the assets you're sitting on, so that you really need to consider, well, I have all those wires out there, I need to replace them eventually, right? And so it's very more methodical when it comes to infrastructure replacement over time. It causes the reserves to go up slightly over time, but it makes it more stable, the utility more stable. So that was a good step. The rates you just heard about, rates are just adequate, no more. We're certainly not making a profit or plating things gold over there. Operations continue to be very reliable. The biggest hits here, as you know, in Rochester are weather events. Whether it's high winds or snow or whatever, the system itself is very, very stable. And we're judged at, we look at that with other public power institutions. Excellent rates here, very good staff. Energy sources are diversifying, that's no new news, right? One of the things that hit the rates this time was peaking generation. It's quick turn on generation, which is something that's sorely needed when you start moving toward things like solar, wind, because there's a need for plugging the hole when the cloud comes over, right? Or the wind takes a break or whatever. So that and the completion of the CapEx transmission projects really has positioned us well. And with the mayor's goal in mind, energy independence down the road, we're moving there. It's not quick. It's expensive to go install a lot of solar and wind on your own, but we're going to make good progress. And with the, I never thought I'd actually think about the end of the Simpli contract being in my reality. You can kind of see 2030 from here. As that approaches, it really helps us in that quest to look for different sources. So that, it's going to be more excitement down the road for a few, but I think we're positioned well. Excellent people, a few of them sitting right here. Sydney, who came to us from a much bigger institution, and Peter, who came with a funny accent. Part of the price you pay for excellence, I guess. Mark and his team have done a great job of filling vacancies and holes over there. The only issues have been, and I'm sure this is true through all the city administrations, pay levels. We get some pretty unique needs within RPU. They're kind of different, different bunch. So that's something that needs some sensitivity over time. But for the moment, in good shape.
Thank you. All right. Anything else? All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Moving on. Mitzi, we have an update on the comprehensive plan.
Younger, and Broadway was anticipated to stay a state trunk highway. Looking forward 25 years, we expect our city will be 160,000 with 52,000 commuters to the community, a major employment center downtown that needs to accommodate a pretty significant share of those commuters as well. Our gateway corridors and primary transit network have been identified as needing redevelopment and needing attention to become more urban. And to be addressed as major gateway corridors that welcome people into the community as well.
I'm holding my question.
Are you? Okay. Just pausing for a moment. We're dealing with global competition that's different than anything we've had in the past. Our effort to secure Rochester as a medical center and as a destination center is something that we have to put attention to, which 25 years ago we didn't. Competition again was very different. This is just a snapshot of kind of our historical growth in population by decade and our projected. A major shift is that our biggest growth in households is in very small households. Small households are dominating growth in demand for housing. You can see that a vast majority of these are in households either with married couples without children or persons who are 65 and older, or simply living alone. I would point out that 63% on the bottom right corner demonstrates the significant share of growth in households, and that's a person 65 years and older. We're seeing a pretty big shift in the market in terms of housing styles that are being permitted, developed, proposed. We don't know if 2015 and 16 are a bit of a blip in our history and will go away soon. Based on this slide, I suspect this shift is something that we're going to continue to see more of. Maybe not as dramatically, but that orange identifies multifamily units that have been permitted, and the blue is single family and townhome development. 2016 is looking very much like 2015, very similar in terms of the the different ratios there. Along with this growth and growth in jobs and population, we have a little challenge here because we also have a projected gap in our labor force. This is not unique to Rochester. And communities all over the state and country are competing for labor, for talent, for people to fill the jobs so they can continue to support economic growth within their communities. Speaking of that competition, we're competing globally and nationally. With the internet, the world is at our fingertips, and access to information has never been easier or faster. Competing for research and development, talent, technology development, in medicine, for labor, for skilled workers, visitors, patients, and events. Luckily, we do have a competitive edge with DMC. It's helping to bring some attention to the community and some investment in areas that will help to draw the kind of talent labor force that we need to secure our future here. So some of the key issues that we need to address in our comp plan, we're really looking at the whole community, looking at these travel sheds, making sure we can ensure sufficient travel capacity to support the growth in the Central Business District in the DMC area, and really shift our focus from not just looking at vehicle capacities on our roadways, but looking at people moving capacity. We need to respond to changes in travel behavior and needs, including changes in mobility patterns of the younger and older generations. And we now have to monitor things like autonomous vehicles, and shared car sharing, and other things that are really transforming the transportation options that people have, much like cell phones did when they started to become available. We need to improve and expand the housing and transportation choices that are available in our community. That includes low-income and zero-vehicle households, disabled and non-driver households. As people age in the 65 and older population, you have a higher percentage of disabled persons. People lose their ability to be independently mobile, and they also need more options available. We're also quite aware that there are significant fiscal constraints in terms of being able to support a growing community, and I have identified some strategies that will help reduce some of those pressures. Ultimately, we need to be a city of choice, a city of choice where people actually want to come and they want to stay. Vision for Rochester's future is developed, drafted by a community advisory committee. And I'll just pause for a moment and let you read through that yourself. Amenities within walking and biking distance, within easy transit access, and just amenities in general. Placemaking, identity of place and areas and their setting, their neighborhoods, and so forth is something that we heard people are very interested in and they want to see more of. Housing diversity and affordability, again, fiscal responsibility, and also health and wellness. Just very quickly, assuring you that we have been taking an integrated approach to looking at the comprehensive plan and the components that need to be addressed. This is an example of the type of thing you'll see in the plan. This is taking a look at that longer-term vision for developing the primary transit network, identifying those major nodes along the corridors that have potential for being station locations and areas of placemaking and mixed use that offer people more amenities within their different neighborhoods throughout the community. But the blue bubbles that you see are something kind of new, and that is taking a look at long-term park and ride strategies that also work together with the transit system development and ensuring, again, that we have means to accommodate 52,000 commuters into the community. We'll be looking at a proposal for phasing out the primary primary transit network, and proposing something that would identify how we could achieve more frequent bus service and bus rapid transit, and what that might look like in terms of timelines. And this is just a reminder of what is a bus rapid transit system, and why is that different than simply more frequent bus service. Bus rapid transit system is one that has more clear identity, branding, that has signal priorities on the routes that it's traveling. Usually you have more station identification, and your ticketing is actually off the bus. You actually purchase your ticket or passes off the bus, so that when you're boarding, you're saving money. Like, all these steps actually help to make those trips quicker. And these services typically run every 10 to 15 minutes. It's very predictable as well. The plan is also identifying opportunities and ways in which both and mixed use can be concentrated along some of those corridors and key nodes. Because we really need to couple the land uses and the development patterns with the development of the transit system and the transportation solutions, because without the demand for transit, you won't have enough ridership to justify the more frequent services. These things all have to work together. So we'll be addressing some things related to transit-supportive land use, including goals, policies, and some guidance that really spell out some of the attributes that will contribute to success. This is an example of something that you'll see. Priorities and strategies. Again, this is just an example on the North Broadway side, looking at some of the major and mid-sized nodes associated with the bus rapid transit, primary transit network development. And within each of these major segments, we'll identify some of the key features, opportunities on the public side in terms of investments and design features, but also on the other side, being on the private sector side, what are some of the key opportunities, densities, types of uses and mixes, and so forth, that will really help to contribute to the success of a corridor like this. It also includes some evaluation tools for helping with some decision making. So, again, this is just an example, but taking a look at a particular intersection, what's the approximate size of development within that node? What kind of development opportunities are there? Private sector, it's kind of a call up to you for some of the opportunities that exist. What's the potential for it to be part of a transit-oriented development? And what are some of the implementation strategies? You also see examples like this, where some low-cost strategies for pedestrian safety solutions, as well as bicycle safety solutions, are identified. As we integrate the transportation and land use strategies, what you'll see is segments of what has been in our long-range transportation plan for ROCOG, the Rochester Olmsted Council of Governments, those urban pieces will be brought into the city's comprehensive plan in this document as well, so it'll be more cohesive and easier for people to go to one single document to find most of what they need instead of having to look between different ones. So if we can try to visualize success, we can identify a place like this. This could be anywhere USA, could be a few different places in Rochester. Not a lot of character, not a lot of place or sense of place identifying with this type of location. But if you look simply at changing what's in the public right-of-way, the public investment piece, you start to see some pretty significant transformation. The things that have changed in this image from the one before include the addition of sidewalks, boulevard trees, prominent crosswalks, safe waiting islands. But when we start to see the private sector following suit with their part of this contribution, we see those buildings being brought closer to the street, being more pedestrian friendly, and being a more inviting people place, creating a real strong sense of place, a mixed use environment. The geography of growth that will be identified includes new and greenfield development, as we've had in the past, development occurring on agricultural lands or otherwise previously undeveloped land. But you're going to probably see more in our future looking at development as infill and redevelopment, In the last 5 years alone, I think you can all think of a pretty significant shift in interest in the market and having new development and tear down and rebuilding near our downtown, nearest our biggest employment center. We think those trends will continue. And they'll actually contribute to helping us manage the growth in traffic in transportation and access to jobs, goods, and services as well. Mapping components will include areas of stability with little or no change. We think that will help when we go out and speak to the community about what this future land use map is, to reassure some folks that we really anticipate very little change in many areas of the community. But then there'll be areas of growth, which would have greenfield, new growth areas, and areas of change, which are more of the redevelopment and infill areas. Like some of these are going to be fairly obvious. You all are quite familiar with where the market has been showing a fair amount of interest. I think there's a lot of synergy in what the market's been demanding, the response from the private sector, and the strategies that we need as a community to become a more competitive place and to manage the traffic that we anticipate. We'll also be identifying areas of development constraints, which might include natural features, but also constraints perhaps on the ability to even expand sanitary sewer. So we're more clear about what the expectation should be about being able to serve certain areas. This is an example of what you might see in terms of the land use types and how they're broken out. Again, the value components that come with that. We'll also be identifying the support systems at a high level in addressing those things. Things like the water system, sanitary sewer, stormwater, asset management, parks, and other pieces. Again, these are high-level evaluations and high-level policies that are typically integrated into a comprehensive plan. Benefits of the plan, we believe, will include economic development, being a competitive city, a city of choice, cost avoidance and fiscal responsibility, serving more people with less infrastructure, housing and transportation choices and expanding those, being more efficient with the infrastructure that's already in place, more residents close to jobs, and more higher frequency transit, more efficient transportation and transit system, lower energy demand and carbon dioxide emissions, overall better air quality, more physically active active transportation community that helps to benefit the community in the way of advancing health. Being America's City for Health. Our anticipated schedule includes January and February having the documents up for review. Meetings, discussions, could include small group meetings. It's going to be a lot of content material to go over. Anticipated March having edits and finalizing. Again, edits that come out of those engagement opportunities. And April beginning the public hearings and adoption process. So it's my overview.
Mr. Hickey.
So I'll ask the same question I always do. Is this going to be a truly comprehensive plan? Are we going to incorporate some of these other, or all these other published plans, either to supersede them or to incorporate them perhaps as appendices or something, so we have one overall document?
The anticipation is that at least as appendices. Now, there'll be policy questions for this group, but ultimately to make some decisions on.
And then,
if you want one plan to supersede another,
right,
they'll have to be clear in some of your decisions.
And then I think, as a minimum, there should be a hierarchy, because we get conflicting plans all the time. So a hierarchy where if there's a conflict, this plan supersedes this, or a comprehensive plan supersedes. So we have one set of rules. All right, perfect.
All right, others, Mr. Wojcik.
This still isn't what I wanted in an update. And what I'm looking for, I want some dates. And 90% of what we've seen today, we've seen before. And I want to know in particular the draft being available date is, when is that date? I see a January review meetings discussion. When is there a draft that the public can download and begin to comment on?
Well,
and I understand that, but
it will be in January.
In January. I mean, that's The original date that we were going to have this to review, I believe, was the first quarter of 2016, and it's slipped a full year on what should be our number one priority. When you say begin public hearings and adoption, what does that process look like? Because my assumption is that the adoption is simply a vote by the council.
No, the adoption is a public hearing with the City Planning Commission, their recommendation, a public hearing with City Council, and a decision. In terms of how the process, what it looks like, I think our staff is fully aware that some of those decisions are out of our hands. So if this council decides that you want seven public hearings, then you'll have seven public hearings. That's your decision, not
Well, what's holding us up from making these decisions today and, you know, putting some count, you know, saying we are going to have a vote on the new comprehensive plan on the first Monday in April?
I think you want to have a completed plan before you can do that. Right now we're working with over 400 pages of material that we're actually still editing and condensing.
And then,
so you have a concise document out there.
You know, when we kicked off the comprehensive plan, I wanted to update the zoning as well because of how incredibly out of date the zoning is as well. I don't see any dates for when we're going to initiate the zoning process, when we're going to finalize the zoning process, and I assume that if we put those dates in the consultant contract, they'll be obligated to deliver by those dates. Do we have any feel for when those are going to happen?
We'll be hiring separate consultants from that work, and I can bring forward a request for the funding as soon as next month if you want.
With that request for the funding, would we be able to have dates whereby we would achieve the results we're looking to achieve?
I would prefer that we be able to hire the consultants first, so we know that we have consultants under contract.
Mr. Bildenbach?
And this isn't so much for Mitzi, but it's for the rest of us and information for Mitzi to take back. Does the council, I mean, I'm feeling that maybe we should be seeing this when we talk about the budget. Am I wrong, Stephen, or should we be having some idea of the cost of consultants for the zoning issue?
For the zoning?
Yes.
There's recommendation for $600,000 in there.
So you already have a recommendation.
So if you approve that, then you have the money to go out and hire a consultant. I don't know the timing after that.
And then how long will it take to hire the consultant? Let's see.
Probably 45 days till he actually gets into under contract at minimum.
And then any kind of, just so we have some kind of an idea, how long do you think it's going to take to do the zoning?
I think we're going to end up having to break that up into pieces, to be quite honest. I think there are some pieces right now that we already know need significant attention, and that's primarily the infill and redevelopment types of projects and incentive and restricted developments. I don't think you have to wait for the comprehensive plan to be done in order to start tackling that piece. Another major component is developing the transit-oriented development, transit-supportive development policies. We're a city who's never had to do that before, and we do need to do it now.
Mr. Wojcik and Mr. Campion.
We do have to do that, except hundreds of other cities have already done this. And, you know, I'd be quite happy taking Madison, Wisconsin's form-based zoning code and adopting it as options for us to apply. I feel like we're going to go down this path of trying to reinvent the wheel on zoning, and a lot of it comes down to commonly accepted factors that other cities have adopted. And, you know, my concern is I don't want to go another 2 years without having capable zoning for the community.
I have no argument there. I'm not looking to see this spread out 2 years, but I am trying to make sure that we cover the needs of what we need in this city.
Mr. Campion.
So I'd like to show something off of this process. And I think looking at what tends to become a bit of a bureaucratic process to remake the entire zoning code, I really like your idea of pick out a piece and tackle that now. I guess what I would like you to come back to us with is which is the right piece? You know, where does your staff have expertise or can build expertise? Because the other side that I don't want to leave out of this is we need to develop expertise to execute this as well. And I know it's not,
you know, it's one thing to just go reinvent the wheel, and I don't think we want to do that by any stretch of the imagination, but having someone go look at what the wheel looks like is a very valuable experience and, frankly, good for our staff. I guess my take on some of what's being said is I think we all want something to show at the end of the comprehensive plan update, and the book is great and the document is great, but it's kind of the results that I think are going to be you know, what we're measured by. So if there is a piece, and I think you hit the transit supportive development piece, if there is temporary or meaningful progress we could make on some ordinances that would enable that development to happen without maybe the full redo, I want the full redo. I can see why. I think we all want it. I think we can see how needed it is. But I think that I would really like to get started, and I think you kind of offered up that maybe that's a strategy to take here. Can you memo? I don't know what's the right format to come back with that in, but I think picking out a piece and talk it, let's talk through tactically what it would take to execute that. Because I think until we see what it looks like when we've actually done something with the new comprehensive plan, I even worry about some of the battles we're going to go through, and I'm fully prepared for this being kind of a battle to get, you know, the thing, seven people steering a ship isn't easy as we go through it. Until we go through and try and apply it, I'm really skeptical we'll know all the problems. So I like that strategy. I would be supportive of trying to carve off a piece why we hire consultants to go figure it out that we maybe try and tackle as a let's do something here and now to show that this comprehensive plan can work and vet it, and then maybe, you know, frankly come back around and fix it if there's problems, because I've written a lot of big complex systems in my life, and man, I've yet to get one right on that first try. Sometimes you always find something you didn't think of that I think we can make better. So I appreciate that. I guess I would really appreciate maybe seeing a memo with you and your staff having some time to come back and say, here's what I think could work. I think that'd be a really great way to handle this.
Mr. Kovac? Mitzi, I think also you had mentioned, and I just want to make a formal request to have you bring back the priorities. Where are the things that you feel we should be looking at? And so that we have an idea, it gives us a chance to go, yeah, we agree with you or no, let's have a discussion. But I think it also tells us where we're heading down that road. So if you could come back with the priorities of infill development, transportation, whatever, so that we can at least see where we're at and where that map is leading us.
Well, in anticipation of a pretty strong appetite for something to happen soon, I had actually reached out to one of our consultant teams and asked for some early ideas on how we could come up with an interim strategy for implementation on the PTN, on the primary transit network, and specifically on the subject of transit-oriented and transit-supportive development. And we have kicked around the concept, and it sounds like there's probably going to be some level of support for it, but a concept of an overlay zoning district for new development would utilize that the overlay zoning standards. And it would identify at least some of those minimum parameters around what attributes need to be there in order to qualify as transit supportive or transit oriented.
Great.
Okay. Anything else?
I do want to also, I read the minutes from the PSC meeting on the where the Stantec report was discussed, and I guess I still have a number of concerns based on, you know, that report spelled out some of the very same concerns that I have, and I think that there's maybe with some folks a bit of denial about how severe the situation right now is in terms of the staffing, the amount of staffing that we have in the planning department. So that's going to be one of the things that I want to know before we finalize the budget, too, is that I want to know how specifically a lot of these staffing and skill concerns that were so prominently displayed in that Stantec report, how they're being addressed by county HR and county staffing. Because if we don't have sufficient planning resources to meet the needs of the city of Rochester, and I strongly believe that currently we don't, then one of two things has to happen. The county or PSC has to put sufficient resources in there to allow them to be successful, or else we have to take control of planning in one way or another so we can assure that the resources are there. What's going on now isn't working for us. You know,
else?
Mr. Staver, you're on PASC. Any actions that you're taking to address the concerns that were laid out in the Stantec report?
Let's talk about that a little bit. Planning Administrative Services Committee is one of several committees that we're all assigned to. I sit on that one. And you're right, the last meeting we did talk, we heard a presentation on the Stantec report. We did give staff some direction in terms of coming forward in their budget with some staffing additions, whether it's sustainability and some other things. But let me tell you, I was recently made aware of Mr. Wojcik's blog. Mm-hmm. And in that blog, he made comments that the PASC is the biggest contributor to the dysfunction of planning, and that the elected officials on that committee show how detached they are from reality.
Two comments.
Sir, I find that insulting.
Okay.
Insulting, and is not conducive to whatever it is you're trying to accomplish here. I find you to be one of the most insolent individuals I have ever worked with. That is not conducive when you publicly bash your colleagues and then you hope to achieve results. It's not going to work, Michael. It just won't. So if you ask what we're doing, we've asked staff, and you conveniently left those out of your comments, that we've asked staff, both city and county, to come forward as part of their budget with appropriate resources to adequately staff the planning department. That's where we left it.
I don't see any direct actions in the minutes that were provided, so if there's something more there, that's good to know. I am very much concerned with this mentality that we don't have a problem with the existing comprehensive plan, that it's not out of date. And you may disagree with that, but you know what? I think the public's not with you on that.
And that's fine. We can disagree on a topic. We can disagree on a vote. That's not what I'm objecting to. I'm objecting to your treatment of your colleagues. That's just not conducive to finding a solution. It is uncivil.
I sit on that committee also. You don't believe I'm detached.
No, and there's no comment. Mr. Staver's not categorizing the comments. There was two sets of comments. In fact, one of them was aimed at a person who didn't sit there. I believe Mr. Staver's comments were that the comprehensive plan was not out of date. And then Jim Beers made some comments, and he's not even on that committee, but Jim Beer made some comments specifically trying to keep the neighborhoods out of the development process. And there were no comments made towards the other members.
But you know, the fact is this council has worked very hard to make sure neighborhood involvement is there, and we will continue to do so. So my feeling is if you're saying I'm disconnected, I don't agree with that.
No comment to you. In fact, I don't know if you were even at that one.
I wasn't at that one.
Yeah.
I am a member of that committee, though.
Well, and here's what it seems like to me, and correct me if I'm wrong. It seems to me like this whole Stantec report is getting swept under the rug. It was brutal, and it was honest, and it was great, and it needs to be acted on. And I'm just not seeing any inclination to reach out to neighborhoods and talk to get their take on what this is. Because if you think that neighborhoods are happy with the way things are going right now, I think you'll find that they agree pretty strongly with what I wrote.
Maybe one or two.
There's 42 neighborhood associations in the city of Rochester.
Yeah.
Some are not very active.
Yeah.
Some are very active. So I think you got to be careful and you got to choose the ones that you're talking about. Not all of them are facing huge developments like others.
Well, I would say every single one of the active ones that I represent.
And there was a great deal of discussion. There was agreement that neighborhood associations do and should have a voice. That was not the issue, and that was not part of the discussion. The appropriate role and when to introduce them into the process, early, during, throughout, or toward the end, that was certainly part of the discussion as well. So there was never a desire to exclude. Mr. Campion?
Obviously... I think I hinted at, like, this is fundamental to the future of Rochester. So I definitely understand some of my frustration with what came out was just the lack of clarity of some of the minutes. I couldn't understand what Commissioner Beer was doing there because he wasn't listed on the roster as part of the members of the board, and he became the chair somehow, so it wasn't super clear what was happening. And additionally, like, you know, I I think I said it at the time it came out. I was concerned about the appearance of the dilution of this council to operate on it. And it was good to see the minutes, so I appreciated you requesting the minutes got sent out. We got the minutes. I think that that was a good step. I still think we need to have kind of our own kind of internal review. And I personally like to hear some more of the dialogue that went on, because I didn't get a whole lot out of the minutes.
And I agree. I mean, I did request that they be forwarded. You lose the context by not having having been there for the discussion. But so I appreciate that, Mr. Wojcik.
So I pulled up exactly what it was I wrote, because I do want the record to be crystal clear on this since it was addressed. The minutes from the PASC meeting that took up this report shows just how detached some elected officials are from reality, and I went out to specifically list all of the comments that that were concerning to me. Furthermore, the positive action at the end of this is that I laid out three steps that I think we need to do. One is a staffing plan ahead of city budget discussions. Maybe we're getting that, maybe we're not, but that's what we need. We need to make sure the staffing is there, because this should be priority number one. Second is a public hearing on the StanTech report, because you know what? There are a lot of people that are affected by how this situation has played out, and they deserve a right to be heard on this issue. This is this was a pretty significant report, and I want to hear what they have to say. And you know what? We don't have to do it during a regular council meeting. There's other ways to do public hearings. I know that'll be another topic. And the third is start of a strategic plan to quickly address the shortcomings, whether they can be addressed in the current form or whether we need a new structure to address the current shortcomings. These are three action items that I think are all doable. I think they're for the betterment of our community. And I'm just not willing to continue to let these things keep going, having these long meetings where basic urban design principles aren't followed because that's what our codes say.
I'd suggest we table this for now and return to it at the end of the meeting, because we have some other presenters that are here. If you want to do it under other business, let's do it that way.
Fair enough. Let's move on to the discussion of the Emerald Hills lift station. Mr. Crawford, Mr. Freeze.
Subdivision by the name of Emerald Hills was built just directly north of Century High School. And the city did not at the time have, they had sewer to serve Century High School, but because the land to the north was lower in elevation, it could not be served by gravity from the sewer that served the high school itself that came up from the south. So Emerald Hills subdivision was installed or constructed with a temporary lift station. And I use the word temporary because it was acknowledged in the development agreement that through the planning that we had done to serve the area north of the high school, that the sewer would come from the north off of Hadley Valley Road. So Emerald Hills was built, 127 lots were created in the subdivision through several phases, and the developer built it, this temporary lift station. We required the developer to provide an escrow to help pay for the cost of maintenance of the system. The developer has faithfully done that. There still exists a small amount of the escrow available for ongoing maintenance. But the issue is the fact that it's now been 17 years since this temporary lift station was put in place. And it serves, as I said, 127 homes. And it's in need of some major improvements. What we'd like to do is present to you today some information that would provide some alternatives. And bottom line is, I would like to see the developer's investment in the future. Not in an upgrade of the current temporary lift station, but a contribution toward a permanent solution for those 127 homeowners in that subdivision. So Matt Crawford, many of you have met Matt. He's an infrastructure engineer, and he's put together this PowerPoint. So So you're going to run it for us. Okay. And this was sent to you in your packet, so you've, I think, seen this. But again, the subdivision is located north of the high school. And again, there were three phases, and Mr. Fred Schmidt was the developer. There was, again, there was consideration of the fact that this was temporary. The development agreement calls it out as a temporary lift station. It's located at the far north end of the subdivision, again, because the property would normally flow by gravity to the north. And in fact, all the sewage does flow to the north. The lift station then pumps it back to the south. So again, this kind of talks about the force main. Is the red line there comes back up through the subdivision and discharges to the sewer that goes south from Viola Road.
It'd be good to know we did have a break in there at one point in 2008 that had to be fixed. So we have done maintenance on that force main already.
Yeah, and the force main is privately owned also as part of the lift station. So we retained SEH to help us prepare a feasibility report about providing gravity sewer. We've looked at, one of the options was, in essence, do nothing. From the city's perspective, let the developer continue to maintain and operate the lift station until some point in the future. Again, there's anticipated a significant investment, maybe of upwards of $100,000 or $150,000 in the lift station. For the next, to get it to last another 120 or another 20 years, and with an estimated cost that may be in excess of $500,000 just for the maintenance. The other alternative, one alternative is for the city to take possession of the lift station. Again, we think investment of that kind of money, both capital and operating, over the next 20 years is money that could be better invested in providing gravity sewer to the area. And that leads us to the third option, which is a gravity sewer option. We actually looked at two alternatives. One is far more cost effective, that being alternative B, where for actually less cost, we can serve a greater area. So the sewer availability charges and the overall net cost of the city as well as the development community would be significantly less. There are challenges with each. We'll talk about that, I think, in the next slide. So the alignment options of sewer is currently being extended up to here. So you would then have to come this way, and we basically have some significant challenges here with the core edge and what some wetland issues in here. And not a lot of this is developable frontage. The other alternative is to pick it up off of the road and bring it up through what was anticipated at the time, which GDPs were prepared 10 to 15 years ago, up an alignment here. Much longer alignment, but a lot less expensive to build because of the lesser challenges associated with this route. The challenges, though, that we have with this route, the pros and cons, if you will, of each, the most significant probably con to the most cost-effective alternative is the fact that part of the route is outside of the city. Some of the landowners may not be willing to provide easements, and to make it happen, the city may have to condemn the property. Being a first city of first class, you now have the ability to condemn property outside of the city, so you would be able to do that if you want to. Go back the slide for a second. So it's this portion right here that would be outside of the city. So it's not the whole route. The city limit line is about right there. It's just this piece right here. But it does present a challenge and potentially affects the schedule to do so. But again, you've seen this information. I won't go through all of these pros and cons, but the one thing that potentially works against the success of the blue line or the blue route is the fact that the property isn't currently in the city and may not be a willing seller. So again, this shows some of the impacts in yellow of the Decorah Edge and the hydric soils that we would have to deal with the green line.
Richard, quick question.
Yes.
Can you go back a slide?
Yeah.
The cost that you showed then for the Hadley Valley Road, how do you go forward? Yeah, the cost there, then go forward one more. And the last point there on the cons, some landowners identified not a willingness. So is that cost that you have in there, how did you determine the cost if that's part of it?
The cost on the previous slide, that does not include right away.
On either option.
Either option. So just construction costs. So in all likelihood, the costs are going to come closer together. But I think the key thing is here that it's about a 5-to-1 ratio as far as the amount of land that you conserve. So the cost will probably come closer together, the overall project cost, but yet your benefit is the fact that you can serve 5 times as many acres for the same amount.
But you're saying the blue route would probably have a higher cost to attain the right of way.
And
that would probably get it closer to even. Okay.
Yep.
All right. Fair enough. Thank you.
Sorry. It's platted along the...
No.
What are these boxes?
Those are lots from a very old general development plan that was prepared probably over 10 years ago.
Okay.
So the plan is there, but it's
no longer valid.
It's correct.
But it does give us an idea of what we would consider as an alignment. We used it for alignment purposes.
Okay, so we used it to align it in support of the property owner. They're going to be an unwilling seller. Is that true?
They may.
Okay.
So again, one of the things we're looking for today is, does the council have interest in us pursuing this? We don't want to go out and start having these conversations if in fact the council says, no, Mr. Schmidt has a responsibility to maintain this lift station for however long it takes before gravity sewer gets there, then that's fine. We just didn't want to start down this other alternative if, in fact, there wasn't any interest on the part of the council.
I have a question, Mr. Hildebat.
Richard, how many property owners are there through this area that you've been dealing with?
I think there are 4 or 5 along this alignment here.
Okay.
And there are about 2 or 3, I think, here.
And you've had no discussion at this point?
We've had no discussions. We looked at the feasibility, tried to put together the cost, wanted to share that information with you, get some idea of where you'd like to go. So again, this is the drainage, the service area. So again, this area is pretty much what you get for service with the green line. All of this area here would be what you get with the blue line. One thing that we have in working with planning, identified areas that infrastructure cost would be the most cost effective is the northeast, because we have trunk lines in place that can serve all of this versus other parts of the community where we're don't have the necessary capacity. So growth in the northeast quadrant here in the Hadley Valley corridor is one area that can be supported by some of the goals that Mitzi talked about earlier.
That was my question, was the strategic plan for the city calls for limited edge growth.
Right. When we design the trunk sewer that comes from the water reclamation plan out to this point, we anticipated that all of this would be ultimately in the city someday.
Okay.
And as a result, everything is properly sized to serve this additional area.
And the comprehensive plan can support that growth in this area that's baked into the plan already?
Question on the alignment considerations and the route through the identified Decorah Edge and hydraulic soils. How do you protect? How do you manage this alignment? And you're going to interfere with the Decorah Edge, or
we will be constructing within it, and as a result, that's why you saw the cost much more expensive to go this route. It's not always possible to restore it to its original condition once you've cut through it. Your Decorah Edge ordinance that you adopted 10 years ago or so does say that the extension of utilities to the Decorah Edge is something that's allowed versus maybe a street not being allowed, but because you may have to do it. So it's a very much more expensive to construct, and there's not always certainty that you can restore the natural functioning associated with the decor edge, the wetlands and associated with that. So it's a much more challenging and unpredictable outcome, both from construction and the long-term environmental impacts.
Mr. Ruska?
So ideally, then, if you could go around with, if you had an alternative to not impact the decor edge, that would be preferred.
That would be preferred. And again, we chose this alignment, as you can see on the map, because the general development plan showed a road here with lots on each side. So again, we're trying to take advantage of something that would benefit the development of this property in the future. We can move it over further and basically not have development on both sides of the pipe. That doesn't make a lot of sense from our perspective. But those would be the kind of discussions we would have with the property owner. And he may say, get it completely off of my property, and we could do that. Again, it shouldn't necessarily change the cost. It reduces the right-of-way cost a little bit. It doesn't change the construction cost. But it isn't as efficient. You've got a pipe that doesn't have development on each side. And again, that's what we were trying to do in an ultimate development scenario here.
Mr. Campion?
I support the second option, and I guess I would just caution us not to overpay for the right of way in this particular instance, because if we do have an ability to, and I'm sure you will, that's our maximum, you know, to some degree, is we can move it off and be inefficient. Right. But let's be inefficient before we get taken to the cleaners, I guess, would be my theory.
Mr. Mayor?
What's the blue on there? Is that surface water or underground? Where you've got, looks like lakes.
That's hydric soils. That's the area that they identified as potential wetlands and issues.
Okay, it's like some places it overlaps one another.
They're different soil types. They're using soil numbers, so different kind of soils associated with those wetland types, and they just overlap. And it's based on depth. So it doesn't mean there's something there, but from the soil types, from the existing geology, shows it could be potential.
Okay. So again, our recommendation to you is to have us begin a process of working with Mr. Schmidt and his attorneys, basically to come up with a contribution agreement. Instead of him investing in the lift station, we'd like him to make an investment in the pipe that would eliminate the lift station, both his future capital cost and his operating costs associated with that, and basically see if we can't come to some agreement on that for the next 60 days or so. And then based on that, if we are able to, we bring that back to you for your consideration. And if you're in agreement with it, and he's in agreement with it, then we would go to the next step, which would be starting to lay out an alignment and start conversations with property owners.
Okay. Direction, I mean, Mr. Campion voiced his opinion. Others, Mr. Hickey?
That sounds good.
Don't get taken to the cleaners there.
Makes sense. Yeah, I would agree. That opens up the most long-term benefit.
The other thing that's benefiting, and you're all aware if you've been out in this area, is that with the county's project now to improve Broadway all the way out to Hadley Valley Road, signalize the intersection at that location, this area is going to be very much in demand for development. And that's one of the lack of a signalized intersection of Valley Hag Road and North Broadway at Old 63 was always a deterrent because it's so difficult to gain access there. Now with the signalized intersection will be completed this next year, that should really help along the sewer to open this area up for growth.
And the previous developer would be contributing some financial resources to this.
Yep.
Can we quantify that or how much that offsets?
One thing that we've looked at, and again this is all preliminary right now, is that fact that, my notes here. The developer paid approximately $128,000 in sewer availability charges back in 1999. To serve this area now, the sewer availability charge has increased to $280,000. We're suggesting the difference of $150,000 be a minimum contribution, plus maybe a calculation of the cost to demolish the the lift station and maybe some operating costs for the 2 years that it needs to get there. So we're somewhere in the neighborhood probably of between $150,000 and $200,000 would be the contribution that we'd be looking at from the developer.
And that would offset some of the costs we saw there?
Yes, it would go towards those costs.
So that those numbers were not inclusive of those.
But again, we haven't had any conversations with the developer or his legal representatives as far as whether those are numbers that they can live with. That's kind of the numbers that Matt has come up with in his his review of this.
Any other questions? Mr. Ruskin?
Other funding for the remaining balance then?
It'd be the sewer utility, and then basically the sewer utility gets paid back as SAC charges are collected from the development over the years.
And then if the developer says, no, I'm not willing to make that contribution, then we just...
I think then we just wait for another developer to come along and want to extend that line from the north.
And he maintains the lift station?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Wagner.
SAC fees cover 100% of all the costs here?
The SAC fee that has been calculated?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I just want to make sure there's no public subsidy for the private development.
All right. Anyone else? So you have the direction you were looking for?
Yes, thank you.
All right, thank you.
The next item on your agenda is an issue dealing with Wimbledon Hills. I sent you out, I don't have a PowerPoint to show you, I sent out the information. It's a combination townhome and up on top of the hill, just east of the country club, south of Cascade Lake. And back in 2009, the city entered into an agreement with the association, settlement agreement as it related to some damage that occurred in the 2007 rain event, the 80 to 100 year rain event that we had. The reason the city got involved is because stormwater that was collected in the city publicly owned storm sewer ran through the subdivision and then out onto the east slope of the thing. So this storm sewer here was private, but yet public water entered it and basically was a contributing factor toward the failure of the stormwater pond that, again, was privately owned. So we reached this agreement back in 2009, and a provision of the agreement was the fact that the city would, and the part of the agreement is we agreed to split the cost at that time 50-50, and the city took over maintenance of that portion of the pipe that conveyed the public stormwater. Another provision of the agreement, though, required the city to seek reimbursement of the $18,000 that the association incurred, their 50%, through state and federal funds, through either the SEM, the Department of Homeland Security with the state, or through FEMA. The city did not do that. The city did not fulfill its obligation. I'm not sure why. I went working with the finance department staff and the EOC director. We went through and we scoured through all of the city records. We made applications for other projects and other reimbursements, but for whatever reason, this particular one was not included in those applications. I don't know if we were told orally by maybe representatives from HSEM or whatever, it wouldn't be eligible, and as a result, we didn't do it. But regardless, we didn't fulfill our obligation under the agreement. So I've had some very pleasant conversations with the association over the last 6 years or so, asking, is there anything we can do? Is there anything the city can do to reimburse them? Because again, of the good faith effort that they, the city and them, entered into back in 2009. And I said I wasn't sure, but the only thing I could do would be bring it to you and see what you thought. So, you know, is it a breach of the agreement? I don't know. It hasn't got to that point that it's a legal issue at this point, but I looked at it, and in reading the agreement, I sent it to you. The city did not meet one of its obligations.
Mr. Atkins, would you care to comment at all?
It's kind of hard when you just hear about something like this and you haven't even read the document.
We'll give you 30 seconds.
Yeah.
if Richard says there's a breach here, I'll take him at his word.
I think he said there might be a breach.
A failure to meet one of our obligations, I guess, does that constitute a breach?
More often than not, yes. As far as what the council can do to resolve the potential dispute, it's kind of hard to come up with ideas unless you have some proposals.
So 1B there is what the specific. So
could you read it for us, too?
So coordinate with Olmsted County for the timely preparation, review, and submittal of the Olmsted County Hazard Mitigation Plan to the State of Minnesota Department of Homeland Security. Within 60 days of the state's acceptance of this plan, the city shall submit an application to the state HSEM office for funding of Phase 2 and reimbursement for owner's Phase 1 costs as herein defined. The city shall notify in writing the owner's rep, Robert Sook, I wonder why Bob was here, of the status of submits and approvals. And apparently you're telling me none of that happened.
Well, we worked with the county and submitted the plan, but we didn't do the second half.
So we satisfied the first sentence, but not the second.
Yep. We did not submit an application.
And it's too late to do so now.
Yes.
So my understanding, is the understanding that the property owners were expecting some reimbursement here and now they're not going to get it?
I don't think that any of us knew for sure whether there would be a reimbursement. But the commitment was the city would apply for one. And we didn't.
And we did that for the county at the time of the event, it was county?
No. The only reason the county's even mentioned it there is because the hazard mitigation plan, which makes you eligible for these reimbursements, was to be jointly prepared, which it was, and it was submitted. Right. And upon its adoption, the city did not apply for the reimbursement.
So, one quick question. So is the dollar amount in question roughly the $18,000?
It's $18,000. That's the amount in question. Then the other part of that is if you are inclined to reimburse them for that, is there any claim or desire to pay them for interest earnings on that? And I've calculated what that would be based on our engineering news record adjustments for those years, and it would be about another $4,000.
Okay. Mr. Atkins?
What I have done in the past, or what the city has done, is when someone has raised the specter of a claim, that they worked through Jenny King of the finance department to submit the claim through the League of Minnesota Cities Insurance Trust, our insurance carrier. If a lawsuit were filed, for example, this would go to the league for coverage, and they would become involved and determine what risks we might have. An adjuster would get involved and determine whether or not some resolution could happen. An idea would be to submit this to the league to ask if they could get involved and work to find a resolution.
Yeah. Mr. Campion?
I like that option, mostly because it brings an objective party in to be the mediator and to propose intermediary solutions that might satisfy the needs of the claimant. So I think that that's a good recommendation, and I'm wondering if what you think of that.
We will do it if that's the direction of the council. I can tell you what the outcome will be.
That is.
Well, I think that's a reasonable approach. It's past practice, and it's, as Mr. Campion said, it introduces a third party more unbiased in terms of determining what that dollar amount might be. Mr. Wojcik.
Well, Mr. Freeze just told us he's confident of what the outcome will be. And
well, I'm batting one for one now in my legal interpretation, so I think I'll just call that good. I think it's going to be hard for the league to rule denial on this, but it's until you ask, the answer is always no until you ask. So
well, I know there are some cases where they've actually suggested a settlement offer.
I'm not going to comment on the matter that the city attorney is referencing before, but I think nonetheless I found them to be a good objective second look can help us sometimes get to an answer faster than otherwise. So I guess the other thing is it's a little bit awkward for us to be bringing a claim against ourselves. So until they come forward and they say what amount they're looking for or whatever it is, I mean, I appreciate the elbow grease and the good faith effort to calculate the interest and all that, but let's let them figure out what they think their cost is, and then we'll, I think, working through the adjuster is a better way to
go. Mr. Wojcik.
My concern, if am I correct that this is the one that we actually had a catastrophic failure with one of the rain events?
No.
Was that the different one over there?
That was the pond behind this, the figure skaters building. That
okay.
was a different event, a different pond, but same general area, just the other side of the road.
Okay. So, and what we'll need from the neighbors then is they need to, first of all, tell us exactly what it is that they want then.
Did we do the full repair?
They paid for the full repair, and we reimbursed them for half.
Okay, I just wanted to know. Okay.
Ms. Main?
Just to understand, it's the total amount to satisfy this, the $18,000 plus the estimated $4,000 in interest?
Yes.
So I'm talking $22,000, but the recommendation is still to go through the leak.
I have no problem with that recommendation. So if that's the way the council wants to go,
Mr. Atkins?
Would any of that be covered by our insurance for that particular year, for that claim year?
Possibly could.
The only way you find out is by contacting the league, correct?
Right. I mean, nobody's asked my opinion, and I very much
should. What's your opinion?
I think there's a public expenditure problem here with us just volunteering this without going through that process. So.
Everybody wants to be a lawyer.
I don't either.
Direction established.
All right. So we have a direction.
Mr. Suck, you. Okay. Because they're going to have to file a claim then. That's what you're basically saying.
Okay. Any more comment on that?
Thank
topic?
You.
All right. Thank you. Moving on to other business, I have one thing, and perhaps there are some others. I don't know if everyone had a chance to look at their email. Based on the discussion or at the end of last Tuesday morning's council meeting, I think there was certainly an effort or people wanted to develop some rules surrounding the conduct of public hearing. What I drafted and what was sent out I just used the format for the open comment period and then created a separate section for public hearing. And I made those comments based on what I was hearing from school board, from other governmental bodies. Mr. Reeves passed some things to me. I read some of Councilmember Campion's comments. So this was by no means a final version, but I put together a draft, and I don't know if others are prepared to talk about some of those things and what you feel truly needs to be part of the rules. I think we all agree that we want to get better control of the public hearing process, no doubt. It's how far do you want to go in terms of establishing parameters?
Yeah, so I think this is really good. The only thing I would suggest is I think after an event like this, you want to jump in and fix it all at once. You know, when you do an engineering problem, you only want to change one variable at a time and see how it goes. Now, this mentions a 5-minute time limit. So my thought, and this is just me, we had talked about a 10-minute time limit, which I think is appropriate. I think the combination of the 10-minute time limit and not letting people cycle around as many times as they want, so just one time unless they're redirected as a question, I really do think that would fix it. And if it doesn't, then we can circle back and get more aggressive. My thoughts on the 10-minute time limit, I think we need to just have one time limit, not one for developers and one for, neighborhood spokesman or whatever. And I just think if someone's, going to pitch a project, 5 minutes is pretty aggressive. And I really don't think most people are ever going to come near. I mean, I think most people speak 2 or 3 minutes. It's just those few people that abuse it that are going to go beyond the 10 minutes. So my thought is a 10-minute time limit, and then you don't speak again on that public hearing unless, directed by the council with a specific question.
And originally I did have that at 10. Let me explain my rationale. Part of it is what I was hearing from other agencies, and they typically use anywhere from 2 to 5 minutes. And more realistically, I thought it's always easier to adjust it up. If we find that, you know, it's just too abbreviated, 5 minutes is just too tight, we can go up. But if we set it at 10 and then try to ratchet it down, it might be more difficult. But I'm willing to go with whatever the group thinks. Mr. Bilderbeck and Mr. Hickey.
Yeah, personally, I think it's really, instead of putting time limits and all this stuff, and I think it's important to let the public speak, and I think it's important to let them come back again. My thing is we need to watch our agendas. We know what's a hot topic. We knew going into this one it was going to be a nasty one as far as time-wise. I don't think anybody could guess 4:17, but we knew it was going to be bad. We knew there was a lot of people who had a lot of things to say. I'm willing to go along with what the council says, but whatever we do, it needs to be consistent. It needs to be out there so everybody sees it, and it can't be coming out tomorrow or later this week or next week. It needs to be out there so people have a chance to look at it and make sure they know it. But personally, I think we just really need to do a better job. We knew this was going to be bad, and when we knew that there was going to be a lot of controversial issues and a lot of people talking, we just need to reduce the number of public hearings that we have so that we can take care of it. Well, that means we have to come in a second night somewhere down that week to hear it, then so be it. But I really feel it's important to let the people have their voice and have their time to speak. So I'm willing to go along with whatever. If we put time limits on there, fine. But I really think that we should be able to take care of this and watch it better ourselves.
Okay. I have Mr. Hickey, then Mr. Atkins, and Mr. Ruskin.
Yeah, so just and back to the 10 minutes, I just would say I'm coming at it just a little bit different than you. Is I really do think this is going to fix it. So if it doesn't, then you ratchet it down. Whereas I'm pretty sure 5 minutes is going to fix it. If you do 5 minutes and no repeats, that's going to fix it. I just don't, again, when I think of maybe a developer trying to pitch a whole project, you know, 5 minutes, I don't think it's completely undoable, but it's pretty aggressive. And I really don't think most speakers are going to abuse that 10-minute time limit. I think most people are at 2 or 3 minutes. It's really those few people that are going to be, reining in the abusers, basically.
Mr. Atkins?
First of all, a clarification. If I get up and speak for 3 minutes of what it be at 5 or 10, I can't come back a second time.
Correct.
So that rule would have to be specific.
Correct.
Secondly, along the lines of what Council Member Bilderbeck was talking, I asked planning to list all of the land use hearings that we held during our day of infamy last week. We had a final plat, an annexation, an amendment to a PUD, a zone change, another GDP, a land use plan amendment, zoning change, and a GDP and a vacation, none of which were butting up against the 60-day, 120-day rule. In other words, you could have continued any of them to the December 5th or a special meeting if you wanted to, and you could have done so legally under the shot clock rule of the state. And so that option is viable if you want to spend some time deciding which ones can be continued in advance of scheduling the matter on the agenda.
And that was the reason for the final bullet that said time-sensitive hearings would be placed first, and that would give us an opportunity to continue or defer others. I've got Mr. Ruska, then Mr. Wojcik.
I was just going to say I'm concerned about having people sit around all night and continuing on, telling them after they've been there for 4 hours that, sorry, you got to come back in 2 weeks. So I hope that we don't get into a situation where we're doing that. I think overall, the majority of the people that come up there, the ones that do it a lot kind of know the system, but the ones that are new and kind of afraid and probably don't have their thoughts collected or PowerPoint presentations together, I want to make sure that they're heard and they feel comfortable. I think they need to be welcomed and need to feel that we're hearing them out and not say, I'm sorry you didn't get your stuff together enough that you're out of here before you're done with your points. And so, I think balancing that all out, I do like the idea of prioritizing these a little bit, although I will admit that over the years we've seen things that we thought were going to be really long, tough battles that ended up being really resolved real easy and taken care of quickly, and some things that we didn't think were going to be big deals that will often become big deals. So it's kind of hard to know that going in. And I would hope that, if we're going to limit people, we do that in a way that's respectful and make sure that people are getting a chance to really understand it ahead of time, that they don't walk in thinking that they find out at the last minute that they've only got X amount of minutes and they can't get half their stuff done. There's going to be some complications that come out of this, and we always kind of, I think sometimes overcorrect after we have a big meeting like this, but I do think there's room for improvement, so I'm open to it. But public hearings are what they say they are. They're for the public to be heard, and Sometimes trying to manage that isn't always real easy, but I think being able to listen it through and give people their moment in the sun. I know the first time I spoke at a podium when I was a young person, I was scared to death. You know, it's hard to get up there and if you don't do it a lot. And so you know, I hope we give the people the respect and the opportunity that they deserve, and that we can work out something. I don't think anything after midnight becomes very productive. Not only is it impact us that night, it impacts the rest of our week. It impacts staff's ability to get up the next day and to do their jobs, and affects all of our you know, health and well-being and everything. So I'm certainly open to some of these changes, but you know, I don't know if we want to do all of them at once. Maybe some, you know, try some and see how they work, or maybe we try the 10 minutes and, you know, go to the 5 minutes if that's not working. But you know, there's a good chance we get done with all these changes and feel like we, I don't want to feel like we cheated anybody. I want us to give the full opportunity to our citizens to be part of our meetings.
Mr. Wojcik and Mr. Campion.
I disagree with the 11 p.m., basically the same reason Mr. Ruska said, that I don't want somebody to sit there for 4 hours and then only then find out. So if we're going to continue something, we do it at the beginning of the meeting, not at the end of the meeting. In terms of trying to fix it right away, some of us have been trying to fix this for years, so I don't think this is a rush judgment by, you know. And the thing I'll point out too is when we have a contentious hearing and we don't know when it's going to start and when it's going to end, I still think the right thing to do for the community is to give it its own time. And you know what? As long as we have a quorum of the council there and we record it, we don't all necessarily even need to be there, as long as we have the opportunity to review the materials ahead of any decision that we're going to make. In terms of the developer having more time to pitch a whole project, well, that's what the whole packet information and the development process is for. So I think those materials are pretty well there. And frankly, I think to everyone's credit on the council, usually when we got something interesting going on in our area, I tend to see the people showing up at the planning and zoning committee meetings. You know, but the biggest thing, and I think, first of all, I've always believed the biggest part of this problem is people didn't realize that they were contributing to the problem, and that's why I've so many times asked for the clock to be put up so people can see how long they're going on. And, you know, I know we said we're going to get it done for the, you know, third time or whatever this time, but I'm willing to, as Mr. Hickey said, take it one step at a time and make these adjustments as we need, see how each one affects the overall.
Mr. Campion.
So I obviously spent couple hours peeling over what other councils do in other communities, and it's really, there's a lot of range, right? We're pretty wide open with what we allow, and it's not about restricting public comment. Honestly, what's most restrictive is when the public comment runs so long that people don't want to deliberate what was before them. You know, if the public comment goes on for 4 hours, and we know that there's three more hearings to have after it, that actually is the most disenfranchising thing that can happen, because those later hearings, people won't even get up. They won't even get up. They'll leave. I mean, we had people leaving last time. So, you know, this is about respect. And I put in the 11 p.m. opening a new public hearing at 11 p.m., I understand that people would be frustrated if at 11 p.m. you find out that your thing isn't going to be heard, but frankly, you might be less frustrated than if you found out at midnight it wasn't going to be heard, or if you found out at 2 p.m. or 2 a.m. it wasn't going to be heard. So I think if we want to set it as 10 p.m., if we want to set it as 9 p.m., whatever you guys want to set the time to, I think it's imperative that we have a point where we take a realistic look at how much progress we've made in the evening. I also think that's why 5 minutes is better to me. I actually like the idea I've seen Minneapolis do, where they say the applicant gets 10 minutes, everyone else gets the other 50 minutes. The ayes go first, the nays go second, and that's how you go. If you're for the project, you better be up there when you call for ayes. When we call for nays, the nays come up, and that's how it goes. And you get through the process, but that might also, too, stop the back and forth, which I think contributes a little bit to the ongoing thing. You're right. A lot of people are the 2 minutes and under. So I think that these rules are hopefully not going to be onerous to them. But I think there's two parts to public hearing. There's the idea that you're making it available for people to speak. But we also have to take into account our need to deliberate some of these issues. And it's been frustrating to listen to 2 hours of public testimony and to have almost no discussion afterwards is, it's deeply concerning to me that we're maybe managing the clock, a shot clock in our head for the other projects to take off. And so we're not, I actually, you know, I spoke to this at our last issue. We didn't speak to all of the aspects of the project. There was a lot, and instead we kind of, there's a lot of other hearings to get to. Let's hurry up and get to them. I just don't think that that's productive for all the work we need to do. So I'm actually more in favor of stricter limits. I like the idea LA has of the speaker cards, because then it, you know, when you start a hearing, there's 15 people waiting to be heard. You can announce that so people can be respectful of other people waiting to be heard. We know there's 4 ayes and there's 11 nays. These are all kind of helpful, I think, to the to having a public hearing that helps solicit feedback for us to act on. So anyway, I put it all out there. You had my midnight ramblings of how to manage that hearing, and I'm happy to release it to the news organization.
You're 2-year-old anyway.
Right.
Guarding the hallway. So, Mr. Bilderbach?
I think the thing is, too, we need to look at this. In the 8 years I've been on the council, we've maybe had 3 meetings that went after midnight. And so, you know, I think, how much are we trying to control? I do believe that Mr. Hickey has the right idea. Let's change one thing here or there to see how that works. But I still believe it's important that we and the city administration look to see what's on the agenda. We know when you see something that's had 2 or 3 runs through public works that it's probably, or planning and zoning, that it's probably not going to be an easy evening. You've seen what's happened in those meetings. We should be able to be quick enough to figure out these things are going to take some time. And I think that's where the priority comes in, to be looking. And there's a point when we know you're going to have 3, 4, 5 contentious items that we stop at for, because we could have done that easily and then still been on there by midnight.
Mr. Ruska, then Ms. Mead.
I'm just going to throw out that, you know, there's been a lot of negative about this, but there's a lot of positive about it, too. You know, we hung in there for 9 hours to make sure everybody did get heard, and we had staff that hung in there all night to make sure that they were there to support that. We have a lot of good community things going on. There's one reason that we're there that long is there's a lot of things going on in our city that are creating this demand, and it's making us take a look, step back and take a look at this, but there's a lot of, I think, good things that come out of a night like that to realize that there's a lot of progressiveness going on in the city and that we're here to do everything we can to make sure it happens. Now, can we modify the process a little bit? I think we probably should. But, you know, again, I don't want to overcorrect too much with the idea that, in all these years, we have one meeting and now we got to change the whole, you know, tip over the whole apple cart. I think we can tweak it some and see how that goes and see where it goes from there. So.
Okay. Ms. Means, then Mr. Bonje.
Actually, I like public hearings as well.
Oh, sure, you're just going to stick it to us now. Make them longer.
No, I tell you, I don't think any of us function as well as we should or do justice to the situation at hand if it's past midnight. Many of you have to go to work the next morning or you have to prepare for your regular jobs. And this one is taking also, you know, 8 hours. So when do you, how does that affect you overall? I did have an issue, and I apologize, but I had to leave at that meeting.
No apology.
That's
necessary.
I'm glad you're
fine. And I was embarrassed to have made that decision. But anyway, I think the public hearings are important, but I do think if we have, you know, a large crowd and many of them are there with one subject, I really think that someone could speak for the group or have one or two people speak for the group and not have everybody speak and not have them come back again. I had someone just look at me so angrily. And that person had spoken already several times. So, secondly, I think the consent agenda, we could probably move along that a little more quickly. And for me, if I have a question, I typically will call Doug Nelson or Mitzi or whomever I think can answer the question and get that resolved prior to the meeting so that we don't have to have that as a discussion item because I've already got an answer.
Okay, Mr. Wojcik from the mayor.
You know, just one thing. It was good that we hung in there for the people who were able to stay and talk, but I know Sandy, who lost her son to a drunk driver here in Rochester, was here to strongly advocate for Uber that night, and she had to leave. She said she just couldn't make it past 2 in the morning, so we're not necessarily letting people who really should have a voice when we do this. And the other is that, you know, it's really easy to say that, well, these groups can get together and coordinate, you know, and some of them can. Some of them have paid lobbyists on staff that organize for them and can speak on behalf of an organization. But neighborhoods, particularly those without organizations, can't do that. And a lot of times people are meeting each other for the first time at these meetings. So I think we have to remember that that coordination is not necessarily always easy to do when you don't necessarily know what other people are going to say.
Yeah, just make a response.
Okay, sure.
You know, we have done this in the past and it's worked. You know, how many of you are here for, you know, item number A? If you have 100 people, do you have one or two people that could speak on behalf? Typically, they've all met anyway in their neighborhood association. So I don't think it's outlandish not to make that request.
Mr. Mayor? Well, I agree with Mr. Hickey at first there. So I'm going to maybe keep it simple at first. I've thought a couple times in TED, instead of having the electronic stuff, I'm going to look at Aaron, the city clerk, or whoever's going to sit in that chair. They could have a little cell phone in front of them and a red card and a yellow card or something, and you can see it and say, you've got 1 minute left or something. But I think, too, you know, part of it is enforcing it. The other night, you told it clearly to someone that you had 4 minutes in the opening comment period, and I think that went 10 or 12, and that's going to happen. I do like, personally, kind of like the idea of the developer or whoever it is that's presenting the project gets 10 minutes and the others get 5. And what Sandra just said, too, you can kind of, you know, ask the group. There's a, I don't remember who it is, but there's a U.S. senator that said that quote is, everything's been said, but not everybody has said it. You know, and that just tends to happen a lot. That you, you know, you heard the same thing over and over again. And so I think we could certainly do something. And I've read, Nick, your comments, too. There's different things in there that I don't think we have to make it so complicated. That it can be a little simpler, but we've got to enforce it. And we ourselves have to take care of not wanting to ramble on and on with certain. There's questions that are legitimate. I understand that. But I think, to me, it's the 10-5, and if you want to keep it within an hour for that, there's still plenty of time for a number of people to comment, and still maybe if somebody has to come back. But I think it's maybe been a few more times than 3, Mark, but
I'm getting old.
Maybe you slept through the last
one. Yeah, it could be.
So anyway, that's my comment.
Mr. Atkins?
I should have mentioned that we did purchase a timer.
Did you purchase it?
With the red, amber, and green lights on.
All right.
Which is a system we use in the appellate courts. As when I argue a case, when any lawyer argues a case before the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, the yellow light goes on when you have 1 minute left, the red light goes on when it's time to shut up, and the justice will cut you off. I have to respond to Ed's comments, though. I physically was there at 4 o'clock in the morning. I wasn't in very good shape. And I made a mistake. I made a Robert's Rules of Order mistake at 2 or 3 in the morning when somebody asked me about a pending motion and a desire to reopen the hearing. Now, luckily, I caught myself. Mm-hmm. But that was mental fatigue, folks. You are not getting my best shot at 4 in the morning, nor are your constituents.
Mr. Campion?
I think the 10-5 is great, but I'm going to strongly advocate for 2 other changes, and I know we don't want to do a whole bunch at once. One is, I think the consent agenda, we need to start considering that with the cow. I think
that's right. We didn't talk about that.
We haven't talked about that yet, but I think bringing staff in to get us consent agenda items during a COW gives us the opportunity to speak, because a lot of those lead to meaningful discussion, I actually find, is when someone's pulled something they feel passionate about or they sit on a committee for, that's good for us to hear. Like, I don't necessarily want all those solved with a phone call, because sometimes that's stuff that I'm not aware of otherwise. And then the other one is,
we absolutely have to set a stop time. At a stop time at night, and apologize to the people in the audience who were there, but I completely agree. You know, I was willing to go to the mat to deliberate all the points of Uber to try and solve this at night. It was 4 in the morning. I mean, how good of an ordinance would we have written at 4 in the morning versus if we were taking that up at 8 o'clock at night? It's night and it's literally night and day. But I think we do a disservice, not just to staff, but also to the people being heard, to have the commentary taking place after midnight for sure. And I actually would support 11 or 10 p.m. because these people have families, these people have jobs, these people have other obligations that limit their ability to participate in a hearing that goes that late. So I think it's unfortunate that it feels like we're kicking the can on certain issues. We just don't have the luxury. Many people don't have the luxury to sit until 4 in the morning, and I say that wholly aware that we all did it, and that I respect all of you for doing that. But let's pick a time. I think that's the minimum we can do.
Well, one thing I'd like to do at the conclusion here is please use this as a draft, and then let make changes to this and try to keep it focused on a single document. Aaron is kind of the keeper of the. Of the document, and Mr. Campion's right. We didn't talk about are we at a consensus in terms of how we handle the consent item. We talked informally about convening this meeting at 3:30 on Monday afternoons. Immediately start with the consent agenda, dispense with those items, recess the council meeting, proceed with the committee of the whole topics for that day, and then adjourn, and then at 7 p.m. reconvene the council meetings and continue with reports, recommendations, and public hearings. Are we on the same page that we want to try that in January, Mr. Mickey?
Yeah, I mean, if we go back and look at meetings, I don't think we typically spend that much time on the consent agenda. I personally like the split, that this is the informal meeting. People show up in the evening for the formal meeting where there's going to be action taken. I don't think there's going to be a lot gained by moving the consent agenda to the evening, and I personally like the format we have now.
Well, in the spirit of maybe not making too many changes all at once, perhaps implementing some time limits on speakers, addressing the consent agenda in the context of the evening meeting will still work.
The only thing I would comment is I intended to suggest we bring both the consent agenda and the recommendation and reports to the COW. Because some of those items do spawn multiple hour conversations. I mean, we had the easement, the Skyway easement, we had a few other reports that have come back, and when those staff reports come back, they can be sizable items, and we're not even to, there have been nights that I've watched where we're not even to the public hearings, and it's 9:15, 9:30. So if we are...
consent agenda.
Sorry, we're not through either the reports, we're not right. To the public hearings by 9:30. That is really indicative of we have a lot of stuff to talk through. So I understand not wanting to change too many things at once, and I can, I just think we have to monitor it, and it's a problem already to some degree. There have been multiple nights we've been going to 11:30, 12:30. I think being realistic, it's every other time almost now that we're going probably beyond what makes a reasonable meeting length.
And then another option for later consideration is whether two meetings a month is sufficient. You know, we may actually have to consider going to 3 meetings a month or something like that, but I don't want to entertain that right now, that idea. So any other comments on the topic? Again, if you want to use this as your platform to jump off and then shuffle comments to Mr. Reeves, Mr. Hickey, then Mr. Bill.
So what's our timeline to move forward?
My thought, the timer is on order. My thought would be that the first meeting in January, that's kind of an unusual one anyway, a lot of formalities and so forth. And I think the public deserves a little bit of notification. So at the earliest, the second full meeting in January is what I had.
When's the timer ready? So I thought you said you had it installed.
We haven't installed it. It should be in hopefully this week. We're going to try to figure out the locations and stuff like that this week with the colony just to make sure they're on board. So it should be, we should have it installed soon.
The only thing I would add is I think we need to have a script for the chair and the if there has to be a chair pro tem or whatever we have to come up with, that is read at the start, that outlines the rules, that just says, for people who don't come that often, we value all your opinions. It's 5 minutes.
And we could do that. We could read it the first few times, but that was part of the reason I put it in as boilerplate, so it's in every agenda package right at the front.
Oh, okay.
It's right on the same page as the rules for the open comment.
The only thing I worry about is people who don't actually read the packet, right? I mean, we get some speakers that'll get up there and...
Right.
So,
understood.
Food for thought.
Mr. Bilderbeck.
I think you're going along with the time... My question is, what time should we have all our stuff to Aaron so that we have an opportunity to review it before we put it into place? And I think there's a lot of things that have been talked about. We're going to have to narrow it down to figure out which one we want. When's the time we have to have ours to Aaron so that we can all get it back and have it discussed and have it figured out so that we can start this in January?
Mr. Hickey?
Does anybody object to starting slow? And then, I think if we, whether it's 5 or 10, so a time limit and then no repeats, it seems like that'd be simple enough to start with, and then we keep adding things until it's fixed.
Yeah, I think let's start with a 10 for the applicant, 5 for everyone, 5 for the total for the applicant, because I find that those go long, and then 5 for everyone else, and let's see where we're at. I actually thought the editorial this weekend did a pretty good job. I don't know that this is the only problem here.
And speakers don't get to come up again unless the council member
requests
has a question, a request. Mr. Wojcik?
Well, I just say in terms of starting slow, I'm happy to see how our clock helps.
Yeah.
Okay.
I do believe Mr. Campion brought up a good point, though, about reading that at the very beginning so everybody understands. So they have it right up front. If they didn't hear it from somewhere else, if they didn't hear it from the press. Or
we get people that walk in because their neighbors tell them or something going on. They don't even have a packet. They just come in. So I think that we need to make sure people are clear and understand what the game plan is.
All right. So if anything, we'll reduce this list. We'll keep it short and sweet.
Mr. Bleed, any comments from staff?
Sure. One thing about the time limit for speakers, I would suggest that you always give the applicant a chance to have the last comment, because there will be a lot of things that come up during that conversation, as you know, and we've always seen that give and take, to go up and basically clarify or respond to some of the claims or accusations or maybe mistakes, so maybe giving the developer 5 minutes at the end as the last speaker.
We call that rebuttal.
Okay.
So maybe they get 5 at the front and 5 at the end.
Another observation, following up on Terry's comment, I think one of the reasons you got so jammed up this last meeting, and I apologize for not being there.
Yeah, right.
But you had people who were requesting continuances to that date, okay? And I think you need to take that into consideration. Terry alluded to the fact that you didn't have to consider all of those. And maybe in setting the agenda, there should be some review. We know what's coming. Planning staff knows, administration knows what's coming. And if you know there's a 3-hour hearing coming from the Planning Commission, it's probably going to be 3 hours at the council meeting, too. And so maybe it doesn't fit on this next agenda, but maybe it has to be.
Our staff are not going to like this, but I guess I'm going to ask the council to support the idea that we put what the time limit is on the hearing on everything that comes forward. If it's a date in the future, how far are we in the 60-day rule so that we know?
I think that's fine.
Yeah.
How far along are we in the 60-day rule? I shouldn't be waiting at the meeting for you to figure out how many 60 days.
I thought you said 40
days. It's so simple, it's brilliant.
Just one other follow-up comment. So somebody who requests a continuance or a tabling, what priority should they get at the next hearing?
Last.
Well, I don't know the answer, but I think you need to consider that, too, because, again, somebody who's on the clock, if you will, should they get or out because somebody didn't have their stuff together or for whatever reason wanted to be. Now, if you delay or continue or table, that's differently than the applicant requesting that. And you've seen quite a bit of that probably in the last 6 months where the applicant are scheduled and then they request a continuance or a table.
It's the same thing to me if staff requests a tabling because the applicant's made a change, is that you don't get priority. You go to the bottom.
Okay, Mr. Mayor?
We had one other line in there that said citizens may only use this forum that's open comment period one time per month. We did that, we'd cut down the length of time dramatically.
Role, right? That's an existing rule for open comment period.
Yeah, but we never enforce it.
Barry's real good about
alternating. They're there a lot, but I think it's every other meeting or so.
Barry's good about alternating. He knows the rule.
It's not once a month.
Yeah. Well, once a month, if he skips every other meeting, it's once a month.
All right.
I was going to say, can we work on it and bring it back to next committee of the whole? Because I actually would like to see it written, the rules. And I think what you're suggesting, running it through Aaron, having bring back something next time that we could adopt possibly at the last meeting or with our first meeting of the new year when we set our rules. And
right. The Home Rule Charter gives the council the right to set its own rules for its proceedings. And so at the organizational meeting, the first meeting in January, I do a resolution whereby you adopt Roberts and the line of succession and all that. You could adopt this practice, this new rule at that time.
That would be good.
Provide for an effective date if you wanted to delay it.
That would be good. Okay, Ms. Means and Mr. Wojcik.
Just want to comment about the committee of the whole meetings. And we have so many people. This is the most popular show in town, I think, television show. But we have probably broken some rules ourselves by having so many people in this room that it exceeds the safety standards. And I don't know what we're going to do about, what you plan to do about that, Council.
Well, the thought I had about that is once the Civic Center is done, perhaps we consider moving the Committee of the Halls to one of the Riverview suites. The rooms like where the DMCC board meetings are held, there's clearly enough seating, the audio is there, it's accessible by the Skyway, there's parking and so forth, and yet it's not too far of a walk for staff. I'm hesitant to go down this road of switching the location. We talked about going to the council chambers or here, and I think we want to make sure we're recording the proceedings. So, that's a topic for future discussion, but once the Civic Center is all done and open, maybe that's a better solution than room 104. Mr. Wojcik.
So, can we jump to a couple other items?
Sure.
Okay. At the end of the last meeting, I raised, my objection that there are issues that the city council wants to discuss that don't make it to the agenda for whatever reason. And so I talked to somebody from the American Institute of Parliamentarians about what the powers of a council is to help set the agenda. And there are sufficient powers of the council that we do not necessarily utilize. What I did is I sent a motion form from another community to Stephen not too long ago, so he hasn't had a chance to forward it on. But ultimately, my belief is that, we are guided by Robert's Rules of Order, and any two council members can make a motion. And it is just fine for those two council members to make that motion in writing ahead of the meeting so that it may be placed in the agenda so everybody comes in being prepared to discuss what it is we're discussing. I don't think it requires any action by staff other than to simply say that should council members choose to utilize this authority, do we want to put it under in the consent agenda, reports and recommendations? Would we want to create our own section? And I don't need an answer on that today, but he can forward you that form. But like I say, any two council members can make a motion for discussion, and this is just a more organized way of doing it and, frankly, a way of ensuring that when a couple of council members want to discuss an issue, it's going to be discussed at that meeting. No action required on that. You'll get a chance to review that. The second thing is just thinking about ahead to the 2017 board appointments. I think it's particularly critical that we work through the city administration to come up with this and not have conversations behind the scenes, because we do run into the open meeting stuff if we have conversations behind the scenes with that. And what I would simply say is it's important. I make this point every few years, but it seems to keep getting lost, that no one on the city council has appointment authority, with one exception, I believe, that the council president actually gets to appoint to the DMCC board, but that's with the consent of the council. Everything else is by consensus of the council, so it's not like anyone gets to pick and choose these seats. So, and I want to make sure that we have an open discussion about that run by the city administrator. And more importantly, I want to make sure that we bring Annalisa in to talk about these things as well, because she has some very good skill sets in certain areas as well, and I want to make sure that we get her in the places where she's most likely to be successful as well. But so this is just informative at this point, but again, it's we'll establish these boards, as always, by consensus of the council and not by appointments.
And it is by consensus of the council.
Yep.
What I do is go through some of the vetting process,
yep,
try to balance it,
yep,
first off, so
yep,
that no one council member has, you know, extra burden.
Understood.
I do try to align preferences, so
yep,
Annalisa, in her case, has already given me four preferred,
okay,
groups that she would like to be on. And then, so we just try to go through that balancing. But then at that first meeting in January, it is by consensus of the council that you hopefully agree with those designations. So appointment is maybe too strong of a word for what we used in the past. It's just the designations, as I listened to all of the chatter from...
My goal here is not to bemoan the process, because I think this has worked pretty smoothly. We don't have a whole lot of conflict with this. In general, people get pretty well aligned with their likes. I just want to make sure that if we get to a point where more than four of us are involved in communications on the issues, that needs to go through the administrator's office as opposed to any sort of direct emails. And that's just that, you know, the transparency that we're obligated to do. And but I this is not a condemnation of the current process. I just bring this up on an annual basis.
Mr. Quinville, had a comment?
Well, I'd be somewhat concerned about, I mean, the communities you serve on is your business, and I'm not sure how. What
open meeting laws? Yeah. The only reason you're involved in this is there's open meeting laws.
I wouldn't
want
to be involved in trying,
yeah,
to determine where the council.
No. But somebody needs to be involved in the communications back and forth, because we can't be emailing
that's
each
fine
other.
I
that's all
on,
I'm asking.
I can pass on whatever,
yeah,
thoughts are you to. You
yeah,
give your thoughts. I'll pass on to
no,
the rest of you.
I would be curious at some point to, just as an aside, if we created an automatic email address that we could use to. That became public information to send notes to the council, if we could just cut human beings out of the process and still comply with the Sunshine Laws.
An automatic email address.
Ultimately an address that would make the information public data. Well, no, because it's not...
But if you've got a quorum involved, I have to,
yeah,
notice that meeting.
You have to notice it. So even working through the... Yeah, This is a tricky wicket to stay within the compliance of the law.
You know, there are lots of nuances of the technology that are difficult. I know, for example, one of my frustrations is folks will send in emails in blind copy.
I know.
So then you don't know who got it, and then I have some reservations. Well, should I respond? It's Council Member Hickey's ward.
Yeah.
Should I respond? Is he going to? And then... Worst case is no one responds, and then the constituent thinks we don't care. Again, it's a nuance of technology that creates some communication issues, I think. But anything else for this afternoon?
That's all I got.
All right, we're here.
Did you send this out in an email?